Hi, my name is Johnny Depp, and I'm very, very, very happy and proud to be here with Chidio, as the work that they're doing is some of the most important work that anyone can do.
Welcome to What's Good, a podcast about cause. It's powered by Chidio, and I'm your host, Drew Hamilton. What we're trying to do on this show is give a megaphone to charity leaders and celebrities making a positive difference in our world to help them spread the word about their cause. Today, we're talking to Larry James, CEO of City Square, an organization that fights the causes and effects of poverty in Dallas, Texas. Let's get to it and find out what's good. Larry James, thanks so much for your time and welcome to the program.
Glad for the opportunity. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. You currently serve as CEO of City Square. You've been here since 1994. So let's just tell the audience right off the bat, what is City Square?
So City Square is a broad-based human and community development corporation, faith-based, began in 1988. And as you said, I came on in 1994. We offer people a wide variety of options for life improvement. We have a large food distribution center that's kind of our heritage. That's how we started years ago as a small East Dallas-based food pantry. But we've gone way beyond that by listening to our customers, our neighbors. We have a public interest law firm, which the four partners in that firm spend all their time virtually in family law courts in Dallas County, defending or arguing for, advocating for, typically women and kids. We have a community-based health center that we've operated since 1990. It's really a fine medical home for about 3,000 patients. We have a large and growing workforce training program. We call it WorkPaths. We do construction trades training, culinary arts, hospitality, IT certifications, and so that's a big part of what we do. In 2014, we opened the Opportunity Center, which is a collective impact center located at Malcolm X and I-30. And it, in addition to having our food distribution center, a good part of our workforce training programs, we also have partners here. We have Workforce Solutions of Greater Dallas, which is the employment office. Right across the breezeway from our training center is the employment office, which is a cool synergy. We have Literacy Instruction for Texas here, which is the largest literacy outfit in the city. And they do ESL, basic adult literacy, GED, and they're a great partner. We have a large AmeriCorps team, which is a domestic Peace Corps, basically, is the best way to understand it. We have 80 year-round members that we use in our work, and we also share with our partners in the community. In the summer, when we do a summer food program for kids who are out of school, we see that AmeriCorps team grow to over 300 members. And so it's a very important part of what we do. We have developed through a community development corporation we founded in 2001 over 1,500 units of housing. We did a complete gut rehab of 511 North Ackard in downtown Dallas, an office building that had been vacant for about 20 years, and we turned it into 200 units of housing. 100 for people who earn less than $30,000 a year, and 100 for people who either were homeless or in serious jeopardy of becoming homeless live there. We also have retail there, 7-Elevens on the ground floor, the University of North Texas College of Law. They have an office there on the first floor as well that complements our work upstairs, because our administrative offices, our law firm, and our community development corporation are on the third floor of that 511 North Ackard building. Abilene Christian University has the entire second floor, a big urban classroom. Then I mentioned the 200 units of housing, and then six condos for sale on 15 and 16 at market rates. And so what we have in that building is kind of a model of what we envision: mixed income, mixed use, kind of a neighborhood and vertical. We are opening, as we speak, 50 single-family homes just across the street from the Opportunity Center. And these homes will house 50 of the most expensive homeless persons to Dallas County. We know by name the top 300 most expensive consumers of public dollars who are homeless. They average costing Dallas County over $40,000 a year to stay outside. we're able to provide high-quality housing with high-touch concierge services and mental health services daily for considerably less than $15,000 a year. So doing the right thing turns out to be the best thing in this case. We're excited about that. We are anticipating more housing development going forward. We're working on that now. And we also anticipate expansion of our workforce training stuff. And so that's a little bit of what we do. We do some other things, but I'll stop there and take a breath.
Well, that's pretty funny because I've got interview questions, so obviously people can't see this because it's audio. But the next two questions were, what are some of the programs you offer, which clearly you just answered right. several of them. And then I was going to have you walk through the math of the cottages,
right.
which you answered without even being prompted. That's just fascinating. I guess people don't realize that it actually costs less to get people off the street by providing that housing.
We are penny wise and pound foolish often in how we use our financial resources. Housing is not only the answer and the solution to homelessness, it's the best therapeutic platform upon which to work. So rather than making people jump through flaming hoops before they can get to housing, we take a housing first approach here. We put people in housing first, and then we work with them to achieve the goals that they may have for themselves. Several things work about that. For one thing, it's based on respect, and it's based on the expectation that people will follow our one cardinal rule, which is if you're going to live in our property, you're welcome, but you must be a good neighbor. If you're dealing with some kind of addiction or if you fall off some wagon you've been on, we're not going to kick you out because you fail. We all fail. But if you bring your failure into the common areas of the community, then we're going to have a problem. It's worked amazingly well. We have almost 100% retention of housing residents after a year of measurement. And it's all because we put a bit of the burden back on the resident and we ask them for help at the same time. And so we say, you know, I spoke to a gentleman yesterday who was moving into one of these houses. And I told him, I said, we're so glad you're here. You're going to help us build a great community. And he looked at me and he said, I'm going to do my best. And so it kind of changes the equation. And it's based on freedom. We have a great team who will be over in that housing development, just like we do at all of our housing developments. But they don't impose themselves. A resident is not required to do anything to stay in our housing. But once a relationship is developed between the resident and our team members, they virtually all get involved. And they begin to work on their life goals, and we help them with that. It's a great experience.
So where can people find out information about City Square?
Well, a great place to go, the best place to go is to our website, www.citysquare.org. You can call 469-904-7016 to get direct information by phone. But the best place, the most comprehensive place, is that website.
All right, and you've written a book called The Wealth of the Poor, How Valuing Every Neighbor Restores Hope in Our Cities. To get people interested, what's the main point of the book? I know there were several, that's why you write a book, but
right.
How would you summarize it to get people interested?
I think the main point of the book is found in the title. We overlook the fact that low-income people have a wealth to contribute to the solutions and to the asset base of rebuilding communities. It's just not green, silver, or copper. It's a different kind of wealth, right? So it's social capital. It's community intelligence. It's survival skills and creativity. I could tell you a million stories about how ingenious low-income people are because they have to be. Well, we don't think to consult them. If I want to know about a problem or about any subject, I'm going to go to the people who have the most experience. And the people who have the most experience with poverty are people who live in poverty. So we've befriended people who are poor, and we've invited them into our world as volunteers and employees, and we've then picked their brains, and we've listened to them. We don't assume we know. I will never fully comprehend all the dimensions of poverty because I have never been poor. But I have friends who have been poor, who are still poor, and they are the experts that we consult on a regular basis.
We'll come back to that. You've touched on something I want to get more into later. But in the preface, you say, as a nation, we've done better in the past in our battle against poverty than today. What do you mean by that?
Well, the data's there. No one wants to admit it. No, I mean, as a matter of fact, if you listen to a lot of talk radio, you hear people decrying this fact, but it's true. In the period of Johnson's Great Society, we saw poverty plummet by 19%. But Johnson got caught in the sticky wicket of Vietnam. And there was a diversion, if you will, of our investment in that war that truncated his Great Society program, which brought Medicare to America. And whatever you think about Medicare today, it lifted an entire generation of millions of senior citizens out of poverty. It intervened in Appalachia in a way that was making a huge difference. But it was all truncated by the crazy wars. And as I look at our history, especially during my lifetime, I'm coming to see the incredibly detrimental effect of war on the quality of life around the world, and certainly in our country. We, during the Bush administration and during the Obama administration, I think we saw some strides back toward more equity. We'll see what happens going forward. But we have done better in the past in attacking poverty, and the data is there to support that fact, than we are now.
You also mentioned there are oppressive factors built into the economic system that work against the poor. Yeah. So tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I think it's, again, if you look at the poverty data and you scratch at it just a little bit, you soon come to realize that the vast majority of the poor in our culture are people of color, disproportionately so. So African Americans make up 12 to 13% of those who are in poverty. In Dallas, the homeless are 70% of African Americans, or 70% of our homeless population are African Americans. So something's not clicking. The education system, the flight of middle class folks from the cities, the tax structure. I mean, I can go on and on and on about the kinds of systems that aren't paying off for portions of our society. Now, what's wonderful is we see again and again great success stories of people who break out of that, and the kids of color and people of color who take advantage of education and do very, very well. And one thing I've learned here is if people have the opportunity and the resources, they can solve their own problems. It's just that the flow of resources here has not reached the kind of equity that we need. You talk about minimum wage, we talk about, you know, income supports that could lift people. There are all kinds of policy things that can be done to help, and it just has not been the case. It's easier, it's much easier being a white male in America because of the privilege that's built into that than it is to be an African American or a Latino.
One of the interesting things from your book, the takeaway, is that rather than living where you lived and trying to solve a problem where you don't live, you took the step and actually moved to the place where you're trying to help fix the problem. And you mentioned how sometimes that we try to help the poor, but they suffer from those of us that are, quote unquote, intending to help.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, those are good questions. People who care about poverty and who do things in response are really cool and good folks with good intentions. And yet, sometimes it's like a paratrooper mentality. We're dropping in and we're doing triage and then we're pulling out. And there's no time for relationships. I think there's a way to do those come and go activities in a way that's helpful to everybody. We believe that if there's not reciprocity in a relationship, that it's not going to work. So that if only one side is giving and the other side is only receiving, that's out of balance. We had to figure out ways for everybody to give and everybody to take. Moving to the inner city, 18 years ago in January, turns out to be no sacrifice at all. I mean, none. We lived in Richardson for 19 years before we moved down here 18 years ago. Very different communities, obviously, but at heart, not so much. I mean, just people doing their best to live their lives and to make a better life for themselves and their kids. But there's been something about our proximity to the people we work with and the people we're trying to partner with to have better lives. There's something about that that has deepened, I think, and transformed our relationship with the population that we care about. Even for people in deeper South Dallas who don't really live near us, when they find out we live where we live, it seems to have some meaning to them. It's almost like there's some surprising credibility. But when you unpack that, it's really ridiculous because it's been a delightful experience for us. And we live in an old house that was built in 1922, and it's been a challenge getting that thing livable. But it's been fun, and we've had a good time, and it's a great place to live.
A lot of people come to you for help. One of the keys to your organization's success that you mention in the book is that a lot of these people end up volunteering mm-hmm. and contributing. How has that helped with the organization's success?
Well, you know, when I first came here, we had 15 to 20 burned out suburban older white volunteers. And they were down here by gum doing their duty to God and country, just like you mentioned earlier. And we really weren't getting very far. You know, I remember I put a coffee pot in the middle of the interview room when I first got here because I love coffee. And one of the volunteers, longtime volunteers, came over and said to me, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm making coffee for our neighbors." And she said, "Don't you know if you make coffee, these people will never leave?" And I told my wife that night, I said, "You know, we're probably a half a bubble off plum here because I'm going a different direction than that." I could tell you a lot of stories. One day I was trying to help three Latina moms and their beautiful kids. They were pulling their limits in English to overcome the fact that I can't speak Spanish. And I knew they needed something, didn't know what. And an older lady, Josefina Ortiz, came walking by. She'd already been to the grocery store. She'd already received her groceries. And I stopped her and I said, "Ma'am, can you help me?" She was startled that I would ask her for help. She said, "Sure, what do you need?" I said, "I need you to translate this interview so I can figure out what these families need." Well, Josefina didn't translate anything. She just sat down and conducted the interview because she knew the ropes. She'd been there before numerous times. And so we were able to help the families. They were going on their way happy. These women were getting acquainted, which is great. The kids are beautiful. I'm thanking Miss Ortiz. She goes to the door to leave. She turns back to me and she says, "Larry, I can come back tomorrow and help you." And I said, "Well, you can see I need your help. Please do." And so she came back tomorrow for 9 years. And she changed the entire culture because I realized we were asking the wrong people to volunteer. It's great to have volunteers from the outside. They're still welcome, and they come. But we continue to invite people who use the services to come back as volunteers to help us make those services better, to be more responsive to the community, and to give us a chance to pick their brain. I learned more from Josefina Ortiz than I've learned from any book I've ever read, just by being her friend and watching her work and asking her questions where she could begin to reveal what it's like to live in a very low-income environment.
Well, that's a nice segue into the next question. It says, you instilled a culture that values curiosity over certainty and people over process or policy. So what have been the benefits of that?
Well, you know, we've got our staff now. I guess we have about 150 people working for us. And we tell them all the time, don't be afraid to fail. If you're not failing, you're probably not trying hard enough. You're not thinking as diverse as you should think. If you're going to fail, fail fast if you can. But don't feel like you're going to lose something if you fail. And that goes along with this curiosity. I mean, I think nothing changes without just curiosity off the leash, if you will. And we do that here a lot. We start stuff, and if we feel like it's not working, we stop it. And if we find some secret that really is effective, we'll double down there. But you don't get those opportunities if you're not constantly pursuing new stuff, new ideas, new insights. We listen to everybody. Everybody's welcome to come and work here with us. We have great partnerships. And so, yeah, I mean, I think people are more important than policy or process somehow.
You end each chapter with a principle, and I really liked principle 2, which states, with opportunity and resources, people can solve their own problems. That's what you were talking about, is the wealth that the poor have.
Absolutely. So. You know, our problem is not, I'll tell you what our problem is not. Our problem is not laziness. I've learned that laziness and sorriness are spread at almost the exact same depth across the entire socioeconomic continuum. I've known lots of sorry, lazy, poor people, and I've known lots of sorry, lazy, rich people. That's not our problem. The scale of poverty is too large for that to be our problem. There just aren't that many sorry, lazy people on the earth. And so what we got to understand is, if people are given a fair chance and the resources to implement their visions, their lives are just better. I learned the hard lesson really early. People don't need me. We all need each other. I get that warm, fuzzy stuff. I love people, you know, but people don't need me. What they need is a fair chance, an opportunity, and the resources to use to help them achieve what they envision.
Can we take a quick break?
Sure.
All right. We will be right back with Larry James.
This is NHL All-Star goaltender Marty Turco, and you're listening to What's Good on Chidio.
Time for a quick plug. You are listening to Chidio. Chidio is a combination of the words charity and video. We are a platform on which celebrities create content for, by, and about cause. Chidio is part of the Charity Network, and right now we're joined by Carson Coldiron, who is the Director of Consumer Marketing for all of the Charity Network. Carson, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, Drew? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like I said, the other two platforms, Charity Buzz and Prizeo. If you wouldn't mind, just a quick description of each platform, and then we'll talk about what's going on.
Yeah, no problem. So Prizeo is our raffle platform. It is an amazing way to get to win experiences with your favorite celebs. The minimum donation is $10 to a charity, and then it enters you for the chance to win a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Charity Buzz is kind of the opposite. Rather than entering to win, you bid to win. So it's an auction platform, similar to any other auction platform, but in this case, the proceeds benefit a cause, just like you mentioned. So right now, we got some really cool things going on. We just released our iPhone app for Prizeo.
Nice.
You can go get it in the iTunes store. We actually have one for Chidio and Charity Buzz already that have been there. You can check out all the campaigns, keep up with what's the date on any of the platforms, videos on Chidio, experiences on Prizeo and Charity Buzz. Specifically right now, we have an awesome campaign going on where you can win a trip to go watch Eli Manning and the Giants play the Detroit Lions. There is an experience where you can go hang out with the captain of the Chicago Blackhawks, Jonathan Toews, get to go to the Blackhawks versus Red Wings game. So we have some really cool sports experiences, an incredible experience with a bunch of different DJs that are all benefiting a charity. And then on Charity Buzz, we're going into the holiday season, so we're about to announce our holiday gift guide. And it is focused on giving rather than just buying items. So we're going to have amazing experiences from all different musicians. We'll have a best of movies. We'll have a best of music, a best of sports, all these incredible experiences that you can buy for yourself or as a gift, and then use that to benefit a cause at the same time.
It'd be a nice way to celebrate the holidays.
I agree.
All right, Carson. Well, thank you for stopping by.
Thanks, Drew.
What's up? This is Emmitt Smith on Chidio. Let's have some fun. Let's get down on Chidio today.
We're back with Larry James, CEO of City Square and author of the book, The Wealth of the Poor, How Valuing Every Neighbor Restores Hope in Our Cities. Where can people get the book, by the way?
Probably, Drew, the best place is Amazon.com. It's there. Yeah. Barnes & Noble's got it online. It's also available in a Kindle format.
All right. And for more information about City Square, the website is citysquare.org. Prior to this, you were serving as a minister. So what inspired you to make the change from ministry to become executive director of what was then known as the Central Dallas Food Pantry?
Yeah. So that's probably a longer story than we've got time to cover completely. But we had Well, let me begin by saying I never imagined I'd ever be a minister. Let's just start there. If I go back to high school reunions, most people still laugh at that notion, right? But I fell under the influence of people in college who got me in touch with my call to ministry, and so I went down that pathway. And that pathway led me through some very interesting preparatory communities. My first church was in the middle of a soybean field in central Arkansas. And so, man, the parishioners were very poor soybean farmers. So I got a taste of rural poverty when I was in college. We moved from there to Memphis, Tennessee, 3.5 years after the death of Dr. King. And that was an instructive year. I worked on a master's degree in Christian thought. And that was an instructive year just to be in Memphis. Then we moved to Shreveport, where we stayed for 2 years and 45 minutes. And I'll tell you about the 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Another show, maybe.
Okay. So, yeah. And for those that can't see us, yeah, he said that and was looking at me, and I just had a big question mark on my face. I was like, well, that's an odd time.
Well, it was an incredibly difficult place. And I was a paragon of wisdom at 23 years old. And I'll leave it at that. Then we moved to New Orleans, where I finished my seminary degree education and worked on my PhD at Tulane in American history. And this was a church that actually provided two churches. One was the typical Sunday church with Texas and Tennessee transplants who had come to New Orleans for business purposes and reasons. The other was Monday through Saturday church, which was pimps and fortune tellers and schizophrenics and incredibly poor street people. My church in New Orleans was just off Canal Street. And so we were right in the middle of everything. Then I come back to Richardson, where I'd grown up, to the church where I'd grown up, and I was there for 14 years. All that time, I had a progression theologically that led me to tell my church I'm believing more and more and less, that the real things that matter, the reality of faith should lead us to the margins where people suffer, hurt, and shouldn't. And I saw that in Jesus, and so it just became very simple for me, simpler and simpler and simpler. I don't have time to argue about, you know, how many angels are on the head of a pin, or all the traditional stuff that sometimes divides churches and gets them off track. And so when I had the opportunity to come into this setting after a lot of reflection, I decided, yeah, that's what I should do.
All right, let's talk about your major annual fundraiser here at City Square. You've had Vince Gill, Clint Black, Steve Martin, Jay Leno, in the last 2 years, Hall & Oates and Jerry Seinfeld. So you do things a little different from just a black tie dinner with a silent auction. So tell us about A Night to Remember.
Yeah, you know, we had a great guy, Ro Diaz, years ago, put together this amateur show in the old Lakewood Theater. And after 3 or 4 years of doing that, and not making much money, but having a great time, one of our large donors came to me and said, look, let's do this in a larger way, and let's get some real talent in here, and let's see what we can do. So happens, in retrospect, our first choice may have not have been the right choice, but it worked that night because it was 15 years ago. Bill Cosby was our first act. It was a smashing success, and so we just went on from there. It's a great night. We've had great talent. We've had great fun doing it, and it does a couple of things. Number one, it exposes a lot of people to City Square who had not known about it before. It gives our supporters a chance to invite their friends and share it that way. And, you know, again, it's just a big celebration of our work. Jerry Seinfeld was hilarious. He did two shows, and the second show was, it was sold out both shows. The second show was full of people who never known anything about City Square. So we've had on our email campaigns, since the night of the event, we've had unbelievable open rates on all of our direct electronic broadcast stuff. It's been unbelievable the kind of open rate we got. And it's to the people who came to Seinfeld. Been remarkable. So it has a residual effect, good PR, expectation about next year, who's coming. People are already asking.
Well, which night to remember do you remember best?
Wow, that's a great one. I love Seinfeld, but he didn't have enough distance for me to really include him in that list. You know, I kind of focus on the talent. We've had some kind of crusty, grouchy people, and we've had some amazingly wonderful people. Jay Leno got on a plane, and en route to Dallas, his brother died.
Wow.
And he came on. And we didn't find out about it until after the show. And when I said to him, "Mr. Leno, you should have called, you should have told us, we could have done something else," he said, "No, you couldn't have." He said, "I knew you had hundreds of people counting on me, so I came on." He also wrote us a $10,000 check.
Wow.
You know, gave us back some money. B.B. King undoubtedly must be considered, and of course he's gone now, but he must be considered one of the kindest, sweetest souls God ever made. He was incredible. Arthritis, very, very terrible arthritis in his knees, but he sat for over an hour after the show and signed autographs. So gracious, so gracious. And Vince Gill, what a great guy. Just a great guy. Hung out with us all afternoon just talking and carrying on before the show, and just a real good person.
Fundraising, obviously a key to any nonprofit survival, and we at the Charity Network are trying to give charities like City Square more options in the digital age. How have you seen fundraising evolve over the last several years?
You know, for us, social enterprise is increasingly important. We have a thrift store, and that's been a big deal for us. It's allowed us to hire 8 people who needed jobs and to return a nice net profit to the organization at the end of the day. Also allows people to engage with us in ways that's helpful to them, both as customers to the thrift store and as donors. We have cracked the code on a lot of public dollars. It's difficult until you get in and understand the system. It's actually much more renewable than one might think. And so we have contracts with Department of Agriculture, or with Child Protective Services, with HUD, with AmeriCorps, Corporation for National Service, One Star Foundation here in Texas. That's been a discovery for us. At the same time, I think we've had increasingly beneficial relationships inside foundations, churches, and corporations. And so we keep, you know, that's where that curiosity really engages for us, because we keep pressing to figure out how to do this better and, you know, how to become a partner in philanthropy. If you have assets that you want to deploy and we can help you do that and our mission aligns with yours, we want to definitely do that as precisely as we can. If, however, we discern that your interests don't align with us, we don't drop you. We try to help you engage with wherever you want to engage, because we know that sharing that, not holding assets or trying to grasp them, is in the long term going to pay off big time for us, because other organizations in the community get stronger, and that's good for all of us.
So have you mastered the art of asking for money, or do you delegate that responsibility?
We all ask for money around here. I've probably led the way in asking for money for a while, probably from the start. I mean, when I came here, our budget was well under $200,000 a year, and this year it's going to be about $18
million. Wow.
So we've grown over the last 22 years. I remember when we were doing the 511 building, the Reese Jones Foundation had just gotten started, and Trevor and Jan Reese Jones were becoming good friends, and they liked what we were doing just with food distribution and with children's programs. And so we got more involved with them. And when we did the 511 North Acard renovation, I remember sitting down with T. Hardy, who runs the foundation, and he wanted an update on everything we were doing, including the building. And I just said to him, I said, "Glad to give you the update, but let me just start with the end in mind. I need you to give me $5 million. And T didn't bat an eye. He said, "Well," he said, "that would be the largest gift to date the foundation's ever given, but let's just talk about it." And so we did, and, you know, he had some conditions and concerns, and we satisfied those, and the Reese Jones family put $5 million in that building. And without their gift and the gift of others, we probably wouldn't have had it.
What's your biggest challenge in running a nonprofit?
Knowing how to align things in such a way that it's easier to stay focused. There's so much going on around here. And I've gone through you know, I've identified and hired my successor. And so in January of 2016, this year, I kind of had a change of role because John Seibert became president and chief operating officer, and I remained the chief executive officer. That's meant for me more time to vision the future, more time to try to raise money, more time to engage in outward facing public activities. So I've done a lot of work with the mayor, with the county judge, and with others trying to affect the larger landscape of poverty in Dallas. And I'm also working on some writing projects. I'm actually writing a second book.
Nice.
So it's kind of in the works.
Do we have a published date yet?
Probably going to be the summer of or the spring of 2018. I got a contract right over there I need to sign and send it back to the publisher, but that's what they're thinking.
Great. Well, that's another great segue because you not only write books, but you also have a blog, and I read your post on Monday where you say you're asked all the time how we should react when we're approached by the homeless who are asking for spare change, and your answer was, I have no idea. That wasn't the end of the post, was it?
That was not the end of the post. No. You know, I think this question, you know, in a good-hearted way, identifies one of our problems. Stereotypical responses to questions probably are not as helpful as coming out of your gut and just being human with somebody. And, you know, if you ask me a question about, you know, what you should do about your children's friends who are a negative influence, I don't have a set answer for that. We got to kind of get into that, right?
Right.
We got to understand what's going on. What are the dynamics? What are the roles of the families? How does it all fit together? Blah, you know, all that. It's the same way when someone walks up and says, sir, could I have a couple of bucks? Well, a standard answer might be no, go to the shelter, or it might be here, take my card. But kind of the intention behind all that is, I have no idea how to help you. I don't want to buy you liquor, whatever. I think we're missing an opportunity to engage a human being who might have something to share with us that'd be really beneficial. So yeah, I got a different answer every time. But one thing that's universal is I'm not going to walk by, I'm not going to refuse to see, and I'm going to do my very best to be gentle and respectful. If you give me some reason to be otherwise, then I'm going to walk away. But I've never had that happen.
So what do you like to do when you're not here at City Square?
I love old movies. I love watching my grandkids play and perform, and that's become almost a full-time job. We have four grandkids, and so we're always at a game or a dance recital or something. I like to read. I like to just sit there and rest. I don't mind being by myself or with my wife. You know, this is just the two of us. So that's kind of it. I'm kind of a boring guy. But the whole focus is our grandkids.
All right, and I'd like to end with this from your book. You said, the question we should ask ourselves shouldn't be, who is my neighbor? The question should be, how can I be a neighbor to anyone in my world? Clarify what you mean by that.
Well, it comes out of the text of the Good Samaritan, right? So this guy, this rich ruler or whomever at the end of the parable says, who is my neighbor? Or he says, who is my neighbor? Because Jesus had encouraged him to love God and neighbor. Who is my neighbor? Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan. And then he says, you know, who proved to be neighbor to this person? So the right question is not who is my neighbor, but rather how can I be a neighbor? That's really Jesus' thought. And I think if we turn it upside down like that, we eliminate judgment, we eliminate stereotypes and categories, and we put the whole focus on ourselves. So how can I be, and who proved to be the neighbor in this story? And how can I prove to be the neighbor without regard to who my neighbor might be? Anyone I meet is my neighbor potentially. But how am I going to be the neighbor that they need?
That's good stuff. I've asked a lot of questions. Now, do you have anything while you've got the microphone, any closing message or thoughts?
I thank you for the opportunity. I sense a growing interest in this. I think people are recognizing that we're out of balance. And one thing that may be better than the past about our attack on poverty is this personal engagement and sense of growing responsibility, you know, that we have when we face people in difficult circumstances.
Larry James, thanks so much for your time.
Good to be with you.
Hi, I'm Bradley Cooper. Welcome to Chidio.
That will do it for this episode of What's Good. Thanks again to our guest, Larry James, CEO of City Square. To find out more about their fine work, go to citysquare.org, and you can pick up a copy of Larry's book called The Wealth of the Poor on Amazon. Visit us at whatsgood.chidio.com to find archives of past shows and to subscribe to this show through iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Thanks again to Carson Coldiron for stopping by to tell us what's happening at Prizeo and Charity Buzz. You can find more details at prizeo.com and charitybuzz.com. And lastly, to find over 100 celebrities creating content for, by, and about cause, come see us at chidio.com. This is Drew Hamilton wishing you well. See you next time on What's Good.